This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas has spent her life writing about people and animals with curiosity and compassion. She studied people in Africa and imagined the lives of human beings who lived thousands of years ago. She's also investigated the hidden world of dogs in a book by that name. Now she's written a book that looks back on her life. It's called Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. She has done so much traveling in her 85 years on this planet, but the road has led her back to Peterborough, New Hampshire, where she lived as a child and where she served on the town's select board. We spoke about her new book at her kitchen table in Peterborough. Thank you so much for letting us into your home.
Thank you for coming.
You've been pretty much a lifelong Peterborough resident, correct?
Yes. My parents came here in 1935. And it's kind of been home to me ever since. But my husband and I have lived all over the place. We've lived in Nigeria for a while, and we lived in Virginia for a long time. We lived in Cambridge, Mass. But this was home.
And this, where we are now, is a family residence, right? Or at least a family plot of land?
It was what my dad got. He was the sort of person that doesn't want to see the smoke of his neighbor's chimney. So... in those days, the farms were being abandoned and sold very low price. He bought hundreds of acres, and there the whole area was then divided between me and my brother. Most of it is under conservation too, but it's essentially one family. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're here, of course, to talk about your new book, Dreaming of Lions. And I guess I should apologize, because in this book you said that you generally write from very early in the morning until very late at night. So we're interrupting your writing time today.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, very good reason for me.
Yeah, but is that true? So you normally write almost dawn to dusk?
Yeah, for some reason I get up at about 3. My dogs want to get up at 3, and there's not much choice. Dogs are there scratching you and barking, and so you have to get up. And I do, but it's a very good time to work. From 4 a.m. to 9, 5 hours there, the phone doesn't ring. You can't do anything else. You can't make your phone calls. You can't go anywhere or shop or anything. There's nothing to do except work. So it's very, very good, and very good for the concentration. It's quiet. It's perfect. I like that time very much.
Yeah. In this book, you write a lot about Africa, your time in Africa. And one of the things you said in the book was that sort of all of your writing has its roots in some way in your time in Africa. What is it about your experience there that makes it so such a foundation for your work?
Well, for various reasons, which I'll explain later if asked, we went into a 120,000 square mile area that was unexplored. We were certainly the first non-Bushman or non-San people who had ever been in there. And the people were pre-contact. And the way they lived and the way they solved their problems and what they valued and what they didn't value was our way of the human way of life for thousands and thousands of years, since we became human, really, since we came out of the trees, just about. That informs a lot. I mean, that's a big thing to know. And you see, I see everything else through the light of through that window.
One of the things that struck me about the people that you were writing about, the thing that you mentioned in this book, is that they were so good at, yeah, they had an eye on the future, but they were also very good at living in the moment and observing. Like, they could look outside and know so much about the soil and the trees around them. And that seems to be something that the average person here in this country nowadays has lost.
Oh, completely. We've lost it. We've lost it completely. First of all, they didn't look outside. They were outside. But if you live in the natural world, as they did, or as any life form does, any mammal or bird at least, you have to live in the moment. You have to pay attention to what's going around you all the time. Because at any moment, a predator can appear, or a opportunity of some kind can appear. So you look and listen. This is very real for them. Interestingly enough, it's a little bit like meditating. When you meditate, you open your mind and let it all in, so to speak. Well, that's what they do all day. They let it all in. And I think it gave them a mindset that's a little different from ours. It's not it's different. I can't quite say how, but it feels they don't have these nervous anxiety fits, although there certainly would be no reason for them not to be anxious about things. I mean, in other words, the San were our ancestors, as you may know, and since we were also hunter-gatherers, the rest of us were hunter-gatherers, they were much the same as we are much the same then as we are now. So in most ways, I'd say.
Do you meditate?
Do I meditate? Well, yeah. I was walking along the street in Peterborough one day, and I ran into a friend. We were in front of the Unitarian Church, and on their billboard that they have outside, they had that there were meditation sessions. And she asked me if I meditated, and I said, oh, I'd like to, but I can't because little thoughts come coming in. And she said, what you do is you look up through the trees and the clouds at the sky and you let it all in. And I did that. And by golly, my mind cleared and I felt great. And I was quite surprised. And but then it occurred to me that if you're doing that, it's like listening instead of talking. Thinking is like talking. You're putting thoughts out. Meditating is letting it in. And I noticed then a few days later, I heard in the woods, I heard something growling. Oh, I heard coyotes howling. And a little later, a deep growling noise. What was that? And I noticed when I was listening, I was just standing there. I wasn't thinking anything. I was waiting to hear what was going to happen or what might have made the noise. I never found out. I haven't a clue. It might have been a bear had encountered the coyotes or something. But anyway, the letting it all in is very much like listening. And when you live in the natural world and have to pay attention to what surrounds you, that's what you're doing. You're listening. Mm-hmm. You're letting it in.
Yeah.
Like meditating.
And thinking like writing. So is writing the opposite of meditating or?
It's the opposite of meditating.
Because you're letting stuff out.
You put it all out, and that's what you're thinking about is what you're putting out.
Yeah.
You don't even hear if the growl some came in the behind you or something. You wouldn't know.
Although you write in your book that you know, your studio, which is, we're sitting in your kitchen right now, and across the driveway there's another building where your writing studio
yes.
is. And you said that you're able in this writing studio to pause and look up and
yes.
watch and then simply go back to your writing and finish the thought that you may have paused.
Yes. We can see the same view from this kitchen that we can see from the... It's the field and the woods and the edge of the field, and a lot takes place out there. And you don't have to miss it. You can just lift your eyes for a minute. There it is.
A lot like wildlife.
It's a lot like wildlife, yeah.
I'm reminded of a passage in your book here where you talk about being in an English class and looking out the window and not only watching the squirrels, but eventually being able to distinguish individual squirrels.
Yes, yes. What they said in the class, I haven't a clue, and didn't at the time.
But you knew the squirrels.
I knew the squirrels, yeah.
Which seems like a remarkable ability to me, to someone who's not so versed in wildlife.
To identify an animal as an individual?
I guess what I'm picturing is from a distance, being able to see and identify individual squirrels. Yeah, I mean, to me, they all just mostly look
they
gray.
They look alike. Well, so do many, I mean, wolves, deer, I've worked on them, lionesses, the lion usually, you know who he is. But, I mean, any population of animals look alike to us. We, I think, look alike to them. No, not necessarily. They're very good. Many animals are good. Chickens, an octopus, well, certainly dogs, wolves, cats, are very good at recognizing individual humans. We're not nearly as good as recognizing individual cats, for instance, unless they're our own. It's a skill, and it comes from living in the natural world that you have to have it, and we don't. I mean, we've done quite something to ourselves by isolating ourselves away from the natural world. We've changed who we are very, very much, I think.
In this book, you have a variety of essays about just some of the remarkable things that you've been a part of and that have happened to you. We can talk about a few of those. One of them is that you were in Nigeria during a coup.
Yes.
And you write that you had the experience of knowing what it's like to be a civilian during a time of war, amidst the war, where yes. killings were happening around
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I bring this up because of partly because of what's happening in Aleppo.
Oh, yes, I know.
And you having been in what may be a similar situation, I'm not quite sure, but what are your thoughts as you hear about what's going on in Aleppo?
Oh, terrible, terrible things. And one certainly feels for the individuals. I mean, you don't know who's shooting at who. First of all, the Nigerian situation wasn't even one half or 1% as bad as Aleppo. It was here and there, that kind of stuff. But Aleppo, it's everywhere. And it's just horrifying, I think. Horrifying. It's the magnitude of it. It's the number of people, millions of people.
Certainly, yeah. And I mean, the starvation that's happening there did not seem yes. to be something that you also experienced while you were in Nigeria.
No, we didn't experience hardships like that. And we didn't have to get up and escape from where we were staying. It was just gunfire, and you don't know who's shooting who, and you see a soldier, you don't know what side they're on. It's you're there in major confusion, not anywhere near the scale of Aleppo. And nobody was bombing us. So it was just soldiers. I mean, just soldiers. But, I mean, that's very different from being bombed. And I imagine, never having been bombed. And thank goodness. Mm.
In addition to being caught up in that particular conflict, you write in this book about a variety of personal and family challenges. Among those, your daughter was in an accident and she was yeah. paralyzed, and your son had a head injury.
Yeah.
And your husband got very, very sick, and he passed away last year. Very
yes,
sorry
he did,
for
yes.
your loss. And you also struggled with alcoholism. So these are really tough things to write about.
Well, maybe I
presume to say they're tough. Maybe they weren't. What was the experience like writing about these things?
Well, there's kind of so much of it.
Right.
It was easy to write about. I mean, it's not that you get used to it or anything, but you learn from it. I mean, you learn from... my daughter was quite something. I mean, she was 17, and she was run over by a tractor and paralyzed. And she, very early on, I mean, she was in the rehab unit. Just after she got out of the hospital, they put her in a rehab unit. And she was in there. She just sort of decided, okay, this is the hand I've been dealt. How am I going to play it? And she played it extremely well. She and the group that she works with are very much responsible for the fact that there's accessibility for on public transportation. And she's been in jail, I boast about this, constantly, 30 times or more.
More times than Al Capone.
More times than Al Capone. She knows the inside of jail. She can tell you how to act if you get arrested, what to do, and when you go to jail, what should you do, and how do you deport yourself, and so forth. She's very good advice, and she knows most of the jails in the country, I'd say. And I'm terribly proud of her. But, I mean, that's one way to look at something bad happening. That was one of the things. She fortunately, just by luck, didn't feel sorry for herself. And if you feel sorry for yourself, then that's your tragedy, and you live with it. And some people who had that experience didn't take care of themselves, or they killed themselves.
Or were killed.
Or were killed, yeah. And the people like her went on to live. I mean, she's happily married. They have a house in Austin, Texas. Lots of friends, got awarded citations by the Austin city government, and so forth and so on. And she, I mean, they're very happy, and they think of being disabled as nothing special, and they manage perfectly well. And so they're happy. My son, too, he had a brain injury because he was a mountain guide, and guide des hautes montagnes, and a French guide. And he was the first American to guide legally in France in the Alps. And he had a sort of nothing accident. He was skiing he was guiding another skier, a client, down a well-known off-trail slope in the Alps. The snow had melted down so that a white stone stood up, and he tripped on it, and he hit his head. Well, that's a nothing accident, if you will, but he did get a brain injury. He and his wife meditate regularly. He got back almost all of his, he lost a large part of his brain, but he got back an enormous amount of, I mean, almost everything. You'd never know if you met him that anything had ever happened to him. There's no sign. And except he doesn't see to the right, his peripheral vision to the right isn't perfect. That's about it. And he forgets stuff, but good grief, I forget more than he does. And that came about, and he had a Korean neurologist who knew about meditation. And he said that it was because of the amount of meditation that they did that his brain had preserved itself. And I think that's quite worth knowing.
And one of the other things that you wrote about here, one of the struggles that you've gone through is struggles with alcohol.
Yeah. When I was growing up, everybody drank. And they had rules. I mean, you drink cocktails in the evening, but if it's a morning celebration, you had alcohol for everything, from marriages to funerals. There was alcohol at the gathering. And it was wine in certain, or whatever, in the morning, and sherry in the at noon, and cocktails at night, that kind of thing. And so everybody drank, and it was seen as good, and I certainly did. But when I was in Nigeria, I got scared and panicky, and I had a very scary experience and had a drink to calm that. And from then on, I just drank too much. But I quit, so that was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, as you write, it's always sort of there in your mind, like a pilot light, which I thought was a fantastic analogy.
Ah. You mean having had that happen?
No, having alcohol and having that sort of feeling with it, the condition of alcoholism, that it's always there in the background.
That's from AA.
The pilot light is that's their analogy?
Well, I don't know about a pilot light, but yeah, the pilot light is always on. The alcohol, you know where it is and it knows where you are, that kind of saying, which is all very true. Another very valuable saying is, I'm not drinking now. I will not drink now. And you say that in 10 minutes and the next 10 minutes and so forth. But it's a somehow people find that a very soothing kind of helpful kind of way of looking at it. And I think AA is wonderful. I wish I could go more often. I used to go all the time, but I mean, once every couple of, maybe twice a week, but now it's in the meeting I like best is in the morning, and I'm working in the morning, so I don't go now, but I'd like to resume doing it because I like the people so much.
Let's talk about Steve.
Yeah.
Because he's such a positive presence in this book.
Oh, yeah.
You have just a wonderful story of the moment you met, or the moment you first saw him. Tell us that story.
Yes, he was a friend of my brother's, and he came to see my... They were at Harvard, and I was at Radcliffe. They came, and he was in the house, and he was lying on the floor. He was... I remember everything. He was wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. And I thought, gee, that's an interesting-looking guy. And he remembers me. I was wearing a dress for some reason. I don't usually, but I was. And he remembers me coming down the stairs. And the thing that surprises me, or when I look back, I liked him because he had a motorcycle and a fantastic sense of humor. It didn't matter what other... And he liked me because of a physical characteristic, which I'm not going to say on the radio.
Oh, come on.
He said, you have had a nice ass. And I thought, really? You honestly? That's here's this person, a fully developed person, and that's all you know. But the marriage worked out very well. We were married we were 18 when we met, and 84 when he died. We were both the same age, just about. Oh, no. We were not the same age. He was 9 months older than I was. Younger than I was.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, this is... I can't... Because women then did not go around with younger guys.
So you learned he was slightly younger and you were devastated.
Yeah, I was devastated. And I thought, this star-crossed romance, this will never be. But we remained very good friends. And eventually... he was drafted. And I went to the train station to say goodbye to him, but then I got on the train with him. And we went to New York, and then we went from New York to New Jersey, and then in New Jersey, a bus was there to pick up the soldiers. And I couldn't get on the bus, so I had to go back by myself. And I was thinking, I never felt so alone in my life until he died. And this happens to half of all the people in the world who have had long, loving relationships. Half of them have what happened to them, happened to me, happens to them. And it's something to think about.
And another story that I love reading in this book, Dreaming of Lions, was the story about the rose-colored pillow.
Oh. He worked in the political spectrum all his life. But when he retired, he went back to his first love, which was history, Central European history. He spoke Russian, Czech, German, French, well. He spoke some Hungarian and some Italian, kind of. He spoke some Yoruba, kind of. You know, he wouldn't even say he was bilingual in Czech, although the Czechs wouldn't have agreed. but he had an American accent. And so he would go to the Czech Republic for 3 months, come home for 3 months, go back for 3 months to research the subject of his interest, which was ethnic conflict after World War I. And that conflict explains much of what happened later. But I would go and visit him. So I was visiting him. He had an apartment. I was visiting him, and we decided to go to Austria. So we drove, and it's all a day-long drive over a difficult road. And when we got to Austria, I didn't have my passport. And this was the thing that was so great. It was his reaction. He said, oh, sort of, that's too bad. We'll go and get it. So we turn around, and we drive all the way back.
About how long was that?
Oh, it was a day.
It was a day's worth of a drive.
Yeah. But also all night. I mean, all day down and all night back. And then we decided we would, then we were walking home, and I saw a pillow in a store window and thought that would look nice on the couch, but no, it's too expensive. We won't get it. But Steve later bought it for me. He completely forgave me. He was never angry at me. He just thought, oh, well, this is what we'll do. And then he bought me the pillow so that I would feel better about what had happened. And we did. We went to Austria. We had a nice time.
But just a remarkable story that he wasn't angry. He was so... He gifted you after you made a mistake.
Yeah, present, yeah.
Well, it's like you say in the book, right? Freud, you quote Freud as saying, to be happy in life, you must marry the right person.
And do the right work.
And do the right work. So this may be a good time to transition back to the work aspect of your life. You started your writing career in a way with a writing contest, correct? That went extremely well.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, I just wrote a short story about a Herero woman in Angola, and I sent it to the Mademoiselle College Fiction Contest. And it Cynthia Plath and I together won the prize.
Sylvia Plath.
I mean, I'm sorry. Of course, Sylvia Plath. Yeah. Well, we won the prize, and I thought, well, that's nice. And then an editor at the... Oh, no, then... Now, how did this happen? Somebody... I can't remember how I started to write the book, my first book, called The Harmless People, about the sand. And then the editor of The New Yorker asked my agent why she hadn't shown the book to him. And she said she had, but whoever saw it turned it down. And he asked me to write another book. And that's kind of how I got started writing all the time. But the other thing was that that was the year I graduated, and the dean wants to talk to all the graduates to see what they're going to do. And she asked me what, my mother came with me to see the dean. And the dean asked me what I was going to do, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I hadn't a clue. And I didn't realize she'd think of that, so I didn't have any answer. And the only thing I really did that I was any good at was writing. So I said, I guess I'll be a writer. And she just blew up. She said, you guess you'll be a writer? Have you any idea how hard it is to be a writer? And I said, well, my agent thinks I could be a writer. And I won the contest and I published a book. That I have a book contract with Knopf. So I think, yeah. And she said, why didn't anybody tell me? And I hadn't known that I was supposed to tell her. So.
And the story ended up in Best American Short Stories too, right?
And it was in Best American Short Stories.
Which is an incredible feat for any experienced writer, but this was your first short story.
Yeah. First short story. Yeah.
I'm just going to flat out say that I'm jealous. Like, I'm just going to admit that. So earlier this fall, you won a Lifetime Achievement Award for your work. Congratulations on that. Is there a way you could summarize your life's work? Is that even possible?
You mean the writing part?
Yeah.
I love writing. I love to do it. I really love to do it. My problem is that, I mean, accuracy is second to what the words sound like. So it's all about what the writing sounds like. And if it's wrong, oh well. If it sounds good, that's good enough for me. I don't want to, I'm not that careless, and I do try hard to make. But I was reading this morning, I was looking at a book I had written, The Hidden Life of Dogs. And I see a mistake in it, okay? And, you know, and, but the sentence is gorgeous.
So it's going to stay that way. You're not going to call your editor and say, stop the presses, let's reprint this one.
It's a very small error. It's a five instead of the number five instead of the number three. Three was correct, five was wrong, but that doesn't matter. I mean, it's all gone now.
Yeah, and the sound of five in that context was better than the sound of three?
I guess it was, yeah. Well, no, it wasn't the word. The sentence was a great sentence, whether it was five or three. So that was the most important thing. The actual information in the sentence was a little less important than what it sounded like.
Mm-hmm. So sound and rhythm is very, very important to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a sentence should be a good sentence, and it should fit in the inner ear hears this stuff. When you're reading it, you're kind of hearing it. And I mean, I read other people's work, think, oh my goodness, you should never have those words in there. You should have them at the end of the that kind of thing.
Because a certain sound, as you write here, unlocks a certain portion of the brain.
I think it does, yeah. I think it does. And I mustn't overstate the inaccuracy business, because I try very hard to be accurate. And I reread stuff and I review it. I mean, I edit everything I write. I edit it hundreds of times before I finish it, before it's finished.
As you say here, revise, revise, revise.
Revise, 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 yeah.
So what do you hope readers take away from your work?
I was born into a family that had a big Newfoundland dog, and she became my nanny. And she would not let me do certain things, like go near water or cross the street. She would just stop me, or she would pull me back, and I would get angry and frustrated. But I was as tall as her when she was sitting up. Our eyes met, and it never once occurred to me that she didn't have consciousness or had thoughts or emotions. Never once. So she and I at the time knew more than the scientists, because science at the time said that animals did not have consciousness. Somebody pointed out that, of course, if you're a scientist, you have to prove what you're saying, and thoughts can't really be proved, so they had to choose whether they did or didn't, and they chose animals did or didn't have consciousness, and they chose the no rather than the yes, which was a mistake. It was a gross mistake, but they made it. And only now, it was that element of things coming into being and being recognized and understood. And it's, I mean, really, really, at this point, we've been with dogs for thousands of years. And, I mean, dog owners know, many dog owners, pet owners knew. Lots of them did, some didn't. And now it's coming. And to me, that's a very important thing. And I try to put that in, I'm putting that in the book I'm writing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what is the book you're writing now?
Well, it's about, I don't know what to call it. It was called The Unknown World, or also A Walk Through the Reaches of Time. I don't know if it'll be, I'm not there yet. And it's about life as it developed bacteria, protists. Nobody knows what a protist is, but they will when they read the book. Animals and fungi, which are related. They have a common ancestor. And plants. And how these things manage and what became what, that kind of thing. It's to give an idea of what's around us. Again, it's a hope of... It's, if you're going to be inside, at least read about the outside. And it's fun to write. It's not finished, but that's one of the points that it makes, is that if an octopus... My friend Cy Montgomery, she wrote the octopus, a book about an octopus.
The Soul of an Octopus.
Doing very well and very, very well known. And who would have thought that an octopus could think, could recognize a person by looking at the person and distinguish one individual from another and act accordingly and solve problems. And I mean, it's just a fabulous thing for people to know. And it's very good that this kind of information is getting around, because an octopus is related to an oyster or a clam and a very different life form than us. But the important thing is that most life forms, even trees, has anybody seen the Hidden Life of Trees? Fabulous book about trees. And most life forms, certainly all the... Does anybody know what a eukaryote is? No. These life forms are eukaryotes.
Not since biology class in high school.
And the paths they've taken are very much the same, and obviously it shows what works, and it explains why we are who we are, why we do what we know or have the abilities we have. And other creatures, including trees, have similar abilities, which they approach in slightly different ways, but the similarity of everything is what's so interesting. And that this book tries to address that subject.
Well, Elizabeth, I hope we get the chance to talk about that one when it comes out.
Oh, I hope we do.
Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
That's Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's the author of many books, most recently Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Elizabeth's bookshelf at nhpr.org. We are always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you, so do send them our way. Our email address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at @nhprbookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in Elizabeth Marshall Thomas's kitchen. Have a great weekend.